I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 18, Episode 5, in which we welcome back our friend of the show, Michael Osbrook, to talk more about the status of Richard Allen and Delphi post-conviction activities. Really dense, great episode, chock full of information. I had to take notes as I was listening. I listened to the episode twice. There was just so much information packed in there, and a great conversation. Definitely have some questions from our wonderful audience. And Michael, welcome in. We're sans Zach, so we are very happy, extra happy to have you, and he is very sad to miss you.
Well, I am absolutely thrilled to be here. As I said on Twitter today, it's always a privilege to be able to talk to Bob about anything and you. And I am really sorry it's next to you.
No, I'm sorry I didn't go on Twitter today. I could be flattered. All right. I know that we've got several questions. I know, Janet, you have a ton of thoughts.
So, and something we'll tells me we're probably going to have some good questions that come through the chat as well, because I know we have a lot of activity in there already.
Yep. I've already got one flagged in there for us to bring up later if we have time.
You want to start? Somebody, so I put up this tweet and there was one answer to it. I said, you know, maybe put in some questions. I got one and it's a really general question, but it's a really good one, to which I have only a general answer.
Let's hear it.
And the question was, what can regular people out there best do to get justice for Libby, Abby, and Rick?
Okay.
And my answer is, I don't have a good answer. Those are two. Justice for Libby and Abby are not necessarily connected with justice for Rick. And I've said this a few places, there are two ways to get justice for Rick. One is to solve the case. That's justice for Libby and Abby. Although, I've got to say, after a conviction, absent just overwhelming evidence of who actually did this, it's going to be really hard to convict somebody else.
Yeah, I agree, especially with what you explained to us about the DNA issue. That was the kind of most disheartening part about it, because I kind of had my mind that's like, well, maybe we can just, you know, test that DNA and figure this thing out. But it seems like that's unlikely to happen.
Well, it's not going to happen anytime soon. It's going to happen. I mean, if it's going to happen either if Rick gets a retrial, or it's going to happen if Rick doesn't get a retrial in the direct appeal, it will happen in the post-conviction case.
Oh, so the limitations you were talking about, was that based solely on the direct appeal piece? That if we move into post conviction habeas work, then it can come in,
right? That and so there has to be a case, and what I was saying if I wasn't clear in the first part of this, is there's going to be, without the prosecutor's consent, which I don't think anybody would get, to get DNA testing done now, Rick would have to file a post-conviction petition as of right, asking for that DNA testing. That would use up his one post-conviction petition as of right, and nobody's going to do that because there's so much else that needs to go into it.
Right.
And can we just circle back on that for 1 second? Because I just had thought, and I was, of course, not at the trial and am very, very, very underinformed as far as this case goes, as much as I've tried to keep up with it. But I had thought, my memory of the DNA, at least as the way it was presented by the state, was that they'd continue to maintain there wasn't enough, and that like the amount they thought they had that was enough turned out to be a lab technician who contaminated the process. Am I crazy? Or is it just that we've advanced technology and it's worth testing whatever minute?
So as I said in the earlier episode, I am not the expert on DNA evidence, but I do know this, and that is that some DNA was tested. What DNA was tested excluded Rick.
Right.
There was some DNA they said there wasn't enough of, but there was also DNA, and it might be the same, they said that wasn't enough of, or overlapping groups, that we just don't do this kind of testing at the state lab, so we didn't do it.
Oh, okay.
In other words, it's testable, but we didn't send it out to people who could actually do it.
Okay. Yeah, I think I didn't realize that. I thought it was just sort of, yeah, I thought it was like, no, there's just not enough. There's nothing to test anymore.
We compared fired rounds with unfired rounds, but we don't send DNA out to be tested by people who don't do our tests.
Right. Before we get too much into all the other questions and stuff, Janet, just to kind of keep with normal form too, I'd like to go through in any thoughts that you have that you want to share or discuss about the episode before we move into the listener questions.
Well, as I said, it was so I've never done this with, and I don't think I've ever done this with an episode before, where I have like 3 pages of notes because I just,
oh, is that
I felt like I was in a class. And so I was just typing everything I was listening to, and I would go back and be like, okay, I want to make sure I got that right, because I definitely didn't want to waste anyone's time by asking a question that was like, nope, that was in there, everybody. Come on, Janet. So I'm just looking to make sure, I guess, let's see. So sorry. Again, just a lot of notes, a lot of notes. Well, first of all, in terms of reactions, this idea that there could be a third sketch out there was a total surprise to me. That I like, wow, what? I'm sure you can't say more, but that was like a big jaw-dropping moment for me.
Well, it's from somebody, you know, I expect it to look like Bridge Guy, because the person who did the sketch, if they did the sketch, described Bridge Guy to a T.
Okay. Okay. So it's not like, oh my God, there's going to be a third utterly different. Well, I mean, I guess it would be different enough.
Yeah. The old Bridge Guy sketch by Sarah Carbaugh doesn't really look like Bridge Guy.
And that's who came forward several months after.
So her sketch was done in June of 2017. The Young Bridge Guy sketch was done
a couple days later, right?
Yeah. 5:30. I think it was done 5:30 in the afternoon of the 14th of February after the girls had been found.
And they were released in opposite order.
They were released in opposite order. And I can say that they're the two biggest lies told by law enforcement in this case, demonstrable lies. The first was the superintendent of the state police publicly saying that the sketch of old Bridge Guy and the sketch of young Bridge Guy are the same person.
Yeah, I remember that it was like a younger person thought he seemed older because she was younger, and an older person thought he seemed younger because she was old. You know what I'm saying? Like, I remember them saying, like, if you put the two together, it's actually a middle-aged person who's neither young or old. I do remember that.
And the second was that the arrangement, that the sticks were just left on the girls to cover them.
Hmm. Yeah, and you've seen, well, I think it's a lot of those crime scene photos end up getting leaked, so a lot of people have seen them. What is your feeling on that after spending time looking at them? Because I've heard that obviously the people that are on the guilty side of the argument say they're clearly just sticks that fell on them. And then the people on the innocent side say, no, these were clearly arranged as some sort of symbolism. What are your thoughts? As someone who really, I do want to make a little aside here, because somebody, it wasn't in the follow-up thread, but somebody did make a post today, which I totally understand. They said, you know, it seems like my approach to Delphi, as far as my guess, has been very one-sided, and they would love to hear from somebody who thinks, from an attorney specifically, who thinks that Richard Allen is guilty. One, I just want to make sure that you're aware that, you know, that I've tried that, like, specifically have, like, on our page. I think isn't one of the guys from Murder Sheets an attorney of some kind?
I believe.
He's technically a lawyer.
Yeah. So, but I have invited him a couple times on Nobody Wants to Come on the Show, which is typically what happens.
I'm going to push back a little bit and say you were pretty harsh about the whole Adnan thing.
Well, so not with them.
No, yeah. But I'm just saying, like, if there's an established phenomenon of, you know, Michael, I like to push back on Bob. That's part of my job. Yeah. But I'm just saying, like, if I thought, oh, this person disagrees with me and this is how I'm going to be spoken of, like, in fairness, I feel like I would be like, I'll skip that. Thank you.
Yeah, I can see that. But also I push back on that and say that group also was invited to come on and have a conversation about it, and they refused to. And so my only choice was to actually analyze the nonsense they were saying.
That made you real mad. That made you real mad.
Point being, whether there's a good reason for it or not, it's not like there's not been an attempt to do so. And also, I'll say that the attorneys like Michael and Bob Mata that we've had on, and Andrea, you know, these are not shills for the defense. You guys are all neutral attorneys who didn't have any reason, no skin in this game. Your analysis just happened to land on this side. So it's not like I'm interviewing Richard Allen's attorney. I'm interviewing neutral attorneys who landed on this, on the conclusions that they landed on. So I just wanted to point that out. I was going somewhere else at the end of that, but I lost my train of thought. So we'll just continue on.
You know, at this point, I mean, you know, you could say that I do have skin in the game on the penny auction theory, and that is that, you know, I've spent 1,000+ hours on this so far. And so, right, each hour I spend is sort of a bet. And so, you know, I've got all this time in, and so, you know, there's bias there because I don't want all this time spent to go to waste. And so putting a little more time in is no big deal. It's like the penny auction. You keep going around, it only costs you a penny to stay in the game.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I think too, I mean, this is something I go round and round with as well, because I am, like, you know, sort of a feelings gal. For better or for worse. And I think it's hard because so much about the world seems very polarized right now. And so the concept of having a rapport with people you don't agree with and being respectful about it and sharing views and agreeing to disagree and all of that is such a great idea. I think it's very hard when you put crime and the legal system into it, because I just think that people get very passionate about the way they have perceived, seen, and processed information. And, you know, like, I would love to say that I stay super open about, for example, a case I do feel like I know a ton about, which is Adnan. And when someone says he should be rotting in jail, whether or not he's a friend of mine, which he isn't, I still think it's a person's life. And, or in the case of somebody, you know, and they think this person took someone's life. So that is a very high stakes thing to be, you know, to not be passionate about. And so, you know, we all try to have grace, but I know that it gets really difficult, especially, like you say, Michael, when you're spending time trying to right a wrong, what feels, you know, was perceived as a wrong. It's really hard to be like, okay, agree to disagree, respectfully, cool, that's fine. You're like, you know, it's really hard, and I get that. And as everyone knows, I'm very conflicted about this case, and I feel guilty talking to you, Michael, because I still feel on the fence about it, and I don't like that. I mean, I'm uncomfortable being not knowing, you know, and I don't want to disrespect anyone who is sure. I really don't, you know.
There's no problem being on the fence, but the problem I have with respectfully disagreeing with people like the murder sheet is that the positions most of the people who think Rick is guilty take have really very little relation to facts, and really to facts beyond that exist beyond dispute. If you want to argue about the confessions, and I think I said this during the episode, anybody who thinks the confessions are a thing, you're not going to be able to argue with him. He's guilty. He confessed. It's over. Don't really care about the rest. Anybody who thinks that the tool mark evidence was anything other than utter nonsense, you're not going to be able to argue with them. I sent Bob the report by Oberg, the state's tool mark expert. On the very front of that report, it says, and it's boilerplate and it's wrong because it can't be right. It says on the front of it that the striations are randomly caused. If that's true, you can't ever do a comparison because random is random.
I do not care for the tool mark. I'm that one drives me insane. So
I feel like if someone were to sit down and have someone who really feels Rick Allen is guilty was to sit down and like point out, like I said, the situation with a non-case in our season 14, I was pretty harsh on, and I stand by that. When you have attorneys claiming authority and then intentionally lying about what's in the evidence in order to make their point, I'll argue that till I'm blue in the face. Prior to that, I've had many people from the other side of our arguments come on the show, and it's always a very respectful discourse. I'm always willing to hear people out.
I agree. Totally agree.
And I feel like this is one of those cases where it's kind of like what Michael is saying. The conversation would go something like this. I don't find the confessions to be compelling. I do find them to be compelling. I don't find the tool mark evidence compelling. I do find the tool mark compelling. And then at the end of the day, it's like, well, I mean, if you find that stuff compelling, then I understand why you think he's guilty.
Right.
I disagree. And there's not much more you can say about it than that. You know, I haven't heard anyone on the guilty side of the argument point anything out to me that, like, as I said, that, you know, if I was a jury, like prove to me he's guilty. I haven't seen proof that he's guilty.
Right. I agree with that. I mean, I would not be able to comfortably have been on the jury and find Richard Allen guilty. I'm not saying that because I am very troubled by how the case went down. But I also, I don't know. I don't know.
If you're comfortable talking about it, because you mentioned to me that this caused you to take even more deep dive into some things, and it's kind of left you, like, it pulled you back more into the unsure area. Is there anything in particular that you want to address along those
lines? Honestly, it's not so much Rick. It's just that I feel the same unease that you feel, Bob, about the, like, what you want is someone else because it's so horrible. What happened is so horrible and you want someone else. And I don't know what I don't know. And I don't feel like Bridge Guy is Ron Logan at all. Like, I don't, like, Ron Logan was so tall, you know, and I know we don't know exactly how tall he is. So this is all like stuff that is so subjective. I guess my sense of the FBI not being involved anymore with Ron Logan is like, they didn't find anything. Like, I don't think they cleared him. I could be wrong. I don't think they cleared him, but I just feel like no one found anything on him. Like, they just couldn't.
Regarding the tallness, and either one of you can correct me if I'm wrong, but because I'm working from memory from a year ago, but didn't the FBI affidavit say that their expert analyzed the video and the height and determined that the body style of the video Bridge Guy is consistent with the body style of Ron Logan? I thought that was part of it.
No, I think you're right.
So, like, for me, it's like, I you've heard me say this on the show, like, when people are, because there are people that are like, that Bridge Guy is clearly 5'5" and then in the video, and then somebody else are saying the Bridge Guy is clearly 6'5". I always default to, there's no way any of us can know this. It takes a photogrammetry expert to know it. And the only information I have at trial, Michael, how tall did they, was there any, there was an expert at trial that testified to the height from the video, wasn't there?
No,
there wasn't. So it was just the FBI affidavit where their expert said that he was similar, consistent build to Ron Logan, which I think what I said that last year when I talked about that was, like, when I read that, not to say that's a correct interpretation, when I read that, that tells me their expert analyzed it. They know how tall Ron Logan was and said, this is consistent enough that we need to get a search warrant for this guy, which tells me that so that's why the height's not a different, not a problem for me. Does that make sense?
See, I'm kind of with Janet, but I'm not at all certain the bridge guy is Ron Logan.
Oh, I'm not either. I want to make that clear too. Yeah, I'm not either.
Well, Ron Logan had a big mustache, and I don't see that on the. And the other thing is that every time you see Ron Logan in public, he's wearing glasses. Rich guy is not wearing glasses.
See, and those are the things that I hear so many on both sides, people talking about facial features and thing on bridge guy. And I've looked at those photos and videos and put them even into all the software I have. And I'm just like, to me, it's just pixels. I don't know how anybody can pull anything out of.
Well, it's funny you say that, because I went all in on the idea that the picture of bridge guy that they put up was faked. And that was because when you look at it, there's a platform right next to a tree. And in fact, when you look at the bridge, there's no tree anywhere near the platform. And it was various other things. I mean, I did it on Twitter, and I mean, I went all in on it. And when the video was finally available and I blew the thing up, it was in fact Zoom compression. It wasn't a fake. It came straight out. The picture they put out came straight from the video.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one has to be a little careful with these things. On the other hand, I have to say, I think it's been proven now pretty conclusively that the picture of the black car, if it is black, I mean, I think there's a question about the color of the car in that in Hoosier Harvest Store clip that they used as an exhibit. But that black car is not a 2012 Ford, 2016 Ford Focus. It is not Rick's car.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step 1, download Rocket Money. Step 2, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step 3, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Thank you for bringing that up, because that was one of the things I actually posted on the follow-up page about documents and photos and stuff, because when I went to, you know what, guys, I'm just like you. I'm just another listener who went to the Truth and Justice Pod
Janet
website.
Did Janet just make a comment?
I went to the Truth and Justice Pod website. I get, I got to crack into these photos and documents. And then I realized that we didn't have them on there. But we're going to do that. I just want to make sure people can access the stuff that was wonderfully describing.
Hopefully by Friday, I'll have. So this is, and I already made this mistake in a previous episode where I went in and was like, oh, we need season 18 in our case document. So I went into our Google Drive. I created a season 18 folder and I threw some documents in there and said, it's up on the website. And then everybody's like, huh? No, it's not. And then it occurred to me that there's no spot on the website that takes you to season 18
right.
yet. So I have to get with Katie, who from createdintandem.com, who does our website, volunteers to do all of our website updates, and ask her to add a season 18 section. So I hope to have that done. She's usually pretty good and pretty quick about getting it up. And I was going to do it today, but I have to make a season 18 logo, which I just haven't had time to mess with today, to give to her to put up for the season 18. So my goal is, it's Tuesday right now, I'm recording this, that by Friday, you'll be able to go to the website, season 18, and all the stuff Michael gave me, I will have up on the, not only in this episode, but in a previous episode where you talked about some of the, like all the post-conviction stuff works, which that again, I think I have it up, but I want to make sure that it's in a place where you can get to it. So yeah, I will get all that stuff up.
Did you get the map of the video that this brilliant woman in Texas did, the where all the business video
I
is?
I did. Yep, I got that, and I want to put that up.
Oh, yeah, so, I definitely yeah, so want to see that.
Yeah, and so it shows that map, and you'll see it hopefully on the website by Friday, you know, the route between Rick Allen's house and the hiking trails and all the places. Now, those spots where it's showing, those not just spots where there are cameras, those are spots where law enforcement has the footage of the cameras, correct?
That's right, because in that little square up in the right-hand corner of the thing, you have, in that's from a discovery list, and it actually lists the businesses.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's super, and when I saw that, I was looking at it on my phone, so I didn't look, but I was like, there's, God, what is there, a dozen cameras that they have footage of, yeah, of the route, so like that they have to have in there conclusively when he came and went. They have to.
Unless he went this incredibly roundabout route, which he said he didn't do. And it just...
Well, and from what, again, I was just looking on my phone, so maybe I didn't see the map as clearly, but it looked like you would really have to go out of your way to go a route that didn't go past all those cameras. Like way, right, way, way out of your way to do that.
Opposite direction, actually, coming in the other.
Right, exactly.
Basically off the map to the east and then back in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the reasoning for matching, their characterization of matching the two cars, the one that they saw in the video and the one in real life, was that you could see through the wheels? Am I remembering that correctly?
They made that claim. There's a woman who's a digital photographic expert in Australia who claims, and she should know, that the pixels showing the light were added.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I, you know, need to get a real expert.
Right.
I can't look. People talk about corruption in this case. I'm not saying there isn't corruption. I'm not saying there is. I don't start an investigation from the idea that I'm going out there to prove corruption.
Right.
If it comes out of the evidence, great. I can't start by accusing people.
Yeah.
Monkeying with evidence.
I want to point something out real quick, just because this is just one of the things that I really like about our audience, where we have disagreements on what I feel about cases, but people are open-minded. I just want to point Lynn in our chat, who is somebody who has said that she always says unpopular opinion, but she believes that Richard Allen was guilty. I just want to read her chat here, because this kind of objectiveness always impresses me. She said, if the Hoover Harvest Store video isn't Allen's car, it's one of the evidence pieces I feel points to his guilt. I'm open to reconsideration if this car video isn't Allen. And we're not saying it isn't, but that's like, to me, that's such a open-minded view to be able to say, I'm not stuck in my opinion. That's one of the reasons I think he's guilty if it's proven. So I just appreciate that, the sentiment, Lynn, in general, but not that I agree or disagree with you, but I just like the fact that you're open to it. But that's one of the things that I want to have up, because to me, with the stuff you were sending me about the car, Michael, like the stuff with the box in the back, again, not saying you're wrong. Like, to me, I'm like, I don't see enough there to be super compelling to me. The thing that I found that was compelling to me, because even though I'm sure there are people that think that I'm also a shill for Richard Allen, I'm not. I'm just really, you know, you guys, I'm super skeptical about everything.
Well, you're concerned with wrongful convictions, and that's what you're looking for. I mean, everybody has their speciality. Is that something only British people say? Everybody has,
not
you know,
anymore.
I mean, we can't escape our expertise or our, you know, the things that we lean towards or that we look for. I mean, you know, but I know that you are also constantly looking at cases that you go, I think this person's guilty.
Yeah,
even though they're saying
what I try to be is an extremely skeptical person who scrutinizes every single detail of a case from both sides. And so, you know, when I see that, it's not to say there isn't something different on the back of the car. I'm being honest and saying, I can't see enough that's compelling to me as a non-expert. Same thing with like any conversation about bridge guy's height or his face. I'm like, I look at it, I don't think there's enough data there. That's not to say someone else can see it, but I'm not going to sit here and say that I see something that I don't say. But the thing that I did find incredibly compelling that seems to be irrefutable to me was the taillight in relationship to the wheel well. That's I don't know how you argue with that. I mean, you can see in the picture of Alan's car where the front of the taillight is in relationship to the wheel well, and you can see where the front of the taillight is in relationship to the wheel well in the Hoosier Harvest video, and that is not the same car. In my opinion, it cannot be the same car, not even close, actually, to being the same car.
And additionally, you know, in looking at that, I think, I don't know if I mentioned it during the last episode, the substantive episode or not, but Rick Allen's car has, at the back, on the roof, an antenna that's mounted on a shark fin. It's on a shark fin mount. And there's no shark fin mount or antenna on the car in the Hoosier Harvest Store video. And there's no way to claim it's an absolutely smooth roof in the clip from the Hoosier Harvest Store video. There's no way that would not be visible.
I was going to ask too. So we have the screenshot of it. Did they show the actual video at trial?
No, and I don't know why.
Oh, yeah, that's Purple Amaryllis was asking that too in the chat. Yeah, that's a great question.
I said I do, but I guess I don't know why. I suspect why is because, you know, looking over the hundreds of cases I've looked at over the years and ones that get thrown at me, just cases you guys don't even hear about that I analyze, I've had many instances where there's like screenshots of surveillance footage and a screenshot of a moving image becomes even more distorted than it is. Then if you just watch the video, if you watch it play through, generally speaking, from my experience, if they had this, the video of the car playing, driving through, if I could watch that car driving through, there are points and times where I could clock, okay, like what does the back look like? What is it, you know, but when you freeze frame it and blow it up, then it's because it's a still shot of something that's moving. It's already blurred. It's not going to be the highest resolution. And so it almost feels like my suspect the reason you only saw a screenshot is because with a screenshot, it's distorted enough that you can make the claim. Where I feel after seeing that where that taillight is, I feel like if I could see that whole video go through, there are other points in that video where I could clearly make out the box on the back, the shark fin antenna on the top, and get a, you know, the coloring, because it, like you said, Michael, it's silhouetted kind of, so it's hard to really get an idea of the color because of the lighting. Maybe further back you can see it's blue, and you know there's so many different things there.
They put about four screenshots of it covering, I don't know, 5 seconds, 8 seconds. They're not, if you put that whole document I sent to you up, that has direct links to all the pictures of the car.
Yeah.
Great. Cool.
I don't know if this is exactly, it's not exactly the same, but to give you an idea of what I'm talking about, has anybody ever experienced this where someone who has a privacy fence, I had the weirdest experience with my father-in-law when I lived in Colorado 25 years ago. We were driving back from some place to their house, and we were driving past one of his neighbor's houses and saw a completely nude woman standing up, getting ready to go sunbathing, as clear as day, right through her privacy fence. And it was the weirdest. It's, by the way, something you guys should know. And it was like, oh my God, you know, we're both like freaking out and went back, and then he called her and was like, you know, people can see through your fence. And then we went later, notice drove by. If you look at the privacy fence, is a still shot, it's complete. You can't see through it at all. But when you move past it, the tiny little eighth inch gaps between the pickets, when you drive through it all together, it looked like it wasn't even there. It was the weirdest thing. And again, it's not the same here, but it's kind of the same thing. So like when it's moving, everything became smooth, but when it was stopped, it wasn't. That's not the same phenomenon with this freeze frames, but it's kind of similar concept.
Yeah. No, that's really interesting. I'm really looking forward to taking a look at those pictures. Yeah. And then I guess if we're just like going to air the stuff that just I still feel uneasy about. And again, I'm not saying I, as a human being, feel like I could make a case for guilt on any of this. It's just like stuff I'm still, I mean, yeah, like, I don't love that he changed the time. I don't love that Rick changed what time he was there. That just makes me really uneasy. But, you know, I don't know.
So here's the thing about the Doolin report. So Dan Doolin is the Department of Natural Resources officer who was sent out to interview Rick. He usually records these things, but this one he didn't record.
This was the very first time, right? Like after the tip, like after he said, he reported himself as having been. Gotcha.
I think Rick called in on the Friday the 17th, and I think the interview was Saturday the 18th. And I know from somebody who was there that Doolin called in the tip to, so there's this group of people who were called Unified Command. It was, I don't know, three or four people, five maybe at the time. And Doolin called in the tip. Don't know what he said about the time, but he said, I mean, he was interested enough that he called it in right away, right? But he also told them, doesn't match the physical description. Mm. And they said, okay, yeah, just send it to the tip file.
And so that was where and what time did Doolin say that Rick said he was there?
So Doolin says he was there, I think from 1:30 to 3 or 1:30 to 3:30. Yeah. And, you know, I wasn't there, but Rick says he said he was there from 12 to 1:30, but they're asking him again 7 years later, 5 years later.
Right. And so that's the discrepancy you're talking about, Janet, because I remember correctly, argument about it in this interview where they're like, mm-hmm. you said this, and he's like, no, I didn't. I said this.
Or so, that he just said, I think I was wrong about that. I can't remember if he adamantly disagreed or if he was like, well, if I said that, I think I was wrong about that, because it would have been more like 11:30. Because I think mm-hmm. it made you a little uneasy at the time, too, Bob. But you're right. Michael, it's really hard when there's a lot, like when you start getting into, the difference between approaching something from a guilty versus innocent versus sort of good faith in authority, good faith in, you know, law enforcement versus approaching that with skepticism and saying, show me the proof, show me that report, show me that report, prove to me that that conversation happened or that recording happened. And if it's just people going off their word, then you can, you know, that's a rabbit hole. And it's, and also all the video that got erased makes me insane, too. I mean, that's just such a huge problem.
But. And mistakes are a thing, too. Is there, and I'm not well versed in this part of it. Did Doolin, that's his name, right? Doolin?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Dan Doolin.
Did he, like, write, are there, like, notes from that interview or a report that he wrote, right? Or did he just talk to him and then call it in and then it got documented? Or is it like, third-hand hearsay where it finally got documented, or did he document the time that Rick said?
I think he documented. Okay. So it's in this giant Orion tip file. So the Orion tip file is a database the FBI gave them to keep track of tips. I expect they've got something similar for the Nancy Guthrie situation. And so it's this giant database that things get put into.
Orion,
and
right.
It's typed up. It was before the days of AI, so I don't think it was dictated or anything. I think Doolin wrote it and put it in there. Now, it was reported by, I mean, there's some other people, dispatchers listed in the, one dispatcher maybe listed in the thing. So, you know, maybe he called it in, the dispatcher typed it up. I don't know. I can tell you this, mistakes were absolutely made. Brad Weber, mother's house was at the end of the private drive. His girlfriend, the night of the 13th to the 14th, so the girls are missing on the 13th, and they're found on the 14th, dead. Something like 2 in the morning on the 14th. She hears some big thump outside the house. She's staying over with Brad Weber at Brad Weber's mother's house. On the 17th, on Friday, she calls in and says, I heard a thump at 4 o'clock in the morning. It's written down. I mean, I don't know whether she wasn't clear or the person taking the thing screwed up. They thought she was talking about a thump on the in the early morning hours of the 17th, not the early morning hours of the 14th. So nobody paid any attention to it because it didn't matter, right? Mm. Well, no, a thump outside the house at 2-something in the morning, right there where the girls were found dead, might matter, right? I mean, you might want to go look for footprints. You might, but my point about this is not that there was anything critical lost. It's that there was clearly a misunderstanding in the transmission of the information from the tip to its being recorded. And the way I know is from Brad Weber's phone, because he's having this conversation with his girlfriend on his phone about her having heard this thump at 2 a.m. that woke her up, didn't wake Brad Weber up. And so you know that it happened in the early morning hours of the 14th, not the early morning hours of the 17th. And it's in the tip file as the early morning hours of the 17th.
There's so much. Yeah, there's just so much there. Oh, yeah. And that actually, I'm glad that you brought that up, Michael, because one thing that I wanted to revisit was, I think because you guys covered so much stuff, it was so information rich. I think I might have gotten mixed up about what is in the motion to correct error and what isn't. I know the van, right, for sure, because you feel that that is the best, potentially the easiest yes you could get from the Court of Appeals, right? The idea that they could and should have known that that Brad's testimony of when he arrived had to be wrong, and that that could reasonably have affected the conviction, not beyond a reasonable doubt, just reasonably could have had an effect. So I know that's in there, but I don't know. I couldn't remember if.
There were four things. Okay. In it. One was a claim that Rick didn't have a lawyer at a critical stage when he was going through the safekeeping nonsense.
Right. I remember that. Yeah. Got it.
The second thing was the van.
Got it.
The third thing was it was suggested that the Reese Davis tips from 2017. The tip, and then his current interview, his interview in June, should have been treated as newly discovered evidence in light of Dr. Kaur's testimony that a box cutter had been used.
Right.
Because
yes. Okay.
Until Dr. Kaur testified, there was a box cutter, that it could have been a box cutter. The Reese Davis stuff was it, you know. Judge Gull had already kept all the Ron Logan stuff out, but that changed things. And then the fourth thing was kind of a cleanup from Stacey Eldridge, the defense's digital forensic expert, saying, no, this wasn't water or dirt. There's nothing in the literature to suggest it was. There's no evidence that the phone was damaged by water or dirt. Some people later said, oh, can't you see there's condensation on it? Yeah, well, there's a little condensation on the screen. That's not water and dirt in the jack.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So, yeah, that makes sense. That fourth piece is, why were you allowed to get up and testify that you Googled something? And that sort of whole crazy affair.
Oh, it's been called a Cecil search now ever since. No. Googling is not a thing. It's a Cecil search.
Yeah, that was also something. But, you know, again, if your lens is like, who cares? That's a big nothing burger. And, you know, all of the information tells us everything we need to know about it being Richard Allen. Then I get why people dismiss that.
Hey, everybody, Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work. And I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month, so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
But again, look, there's an expert who testified. There was headphone activity at 5:35. And I think it was 10:32, but I, you know, whatever, 10 something. And yeah, I mean, if you want to ignore an unrebutted fact, and by the way, there was there was audio input activity before they ever crossed the creek, if they did cross the creek. So is that mud and water too?
Is that one of the things that Stacey said I would have tested? Did she testify to that, or was that sort of a post? Kind of, I wish I could have said that, but no one asked me on the stand. I can't remember because I know you mentioned that there was a question about
I'm sorry to interrupt you. She absolutely testified that there was this headphone activity, headphones in, headphones out. And Nick McClellan, the prosecutor, in an interview later, said, yeah, we knew about that, but we thought it was so crazy they'd never use it. I mean, It shows somebody's handling the phone.
Yeah.
After you say the girls were dead at 2:32. And by the way, the timeline, you all say that Sarah Carbaugh saw Rick Allen on 300, this road that runs by the crime scene, at 3:56 before 4 o'clock. But yet somebody, and so the whole, everything's, you know, set in stone. The girls are dead. The phone's at the crime scene. And yet at 5:35 and then 5 hours later, somebody's handling the phone with headphones. I mean, it's a critical piece of evidence. Yeah. And if you want to just wave your hands and say it doesn't matter, right. Well, I can't. You can't have a discussion with somebody like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely. I mean, I don't disagree. Let me just look. I want to make sure we hit some list. Although we have hit some listener questions just by virtue of what's come up in conversation. We shouted out a couple of them. But Gary, I know Gary kind of fell on the side of thinking it was maybe nothing. Maybe that the headphones thing is a red herring. But again, I agree that like you wouldn't want anybody who thinks like, I always try to do this, and I think we do really try to do this on this show, but is like to imagine it's the reverse. Imagine that you feel passionately that someone is or isn't responsible for something. Just put, you know, and imagine that you're watching a trial, and imagine that you strongly believe X, and then and an expert testifies, and you agree with what the expert testifies, and then just imagine someone else getting up and saying, "Well, I did a Google search." So, like, just even if you don't agree with it in this case, imagine something you are passionate about, and imagine someone saying, "I Googled it," and imagine how infuriating that would be, and how
right.
antithetical to what the legal system, how it's all supposed to run. Like, just imagine it didn't go in your favor, and try to be intellectually honest about how much you would be like, "They Googled it?" Like, everyone would say that unless they right. felt that it helped them towards their side. Yeah. I believe that you have to say
I think
that
most
crazy.
People, yeah, most people, if it, particularly if it cut against their belief, I mean, you have expert testimony versus someone stepping out and Googling something. Obviously, most people wouldn't accept that. Personally, I have my issue with this, with the whole cell phone thing is, like, I'm certainly not going against the expert. I'm open to the idea that there could be some other malfunction. You know, phones do stupid, weird things. My daughter was just at Verizon for an hour and a half today trying to fix some stupid, weird thing on her phone today that it was doing. So I'm open to that. But then also, I think that I think it tends to, like, get talked about and then, like, moved beyond it as quickly from, I guess, particularly the guilty side, because it's certainly not helpful to their side. But also because there's not a clear if this, then this thing, right? So it's not like, oh, well, if somebody did plug headphones into it, then clearly it was this person, because we know they plugged things into, you know, it's like, for me at least, I'm like, okay, so if that happened, yeah, like Michael said, that would prove that somebody was handling the phone. But also, what the fuck, what? Like, they're just plugging in headphones and not doing anything else at 5 o'clock in the morning. I can't wrap my brain around what that would be about. Well, not
the
that there's
yeah, the utility of that
no,
motion.
It's,
would
it's
be.
5 in the afternoon
or 5 in the afternoon, whenever it is, after the girls are dead, they're plugging in. I mean, I've heard different theories and stuff, and I know, and I don't want to go to, because we're already almost
well,
an
actually,
hour into this.
Yeah, I could just quickly insert that Nancy C said on our Facebook, "I've always wondered if the headphones in the phone was the issue of the insert being only 50% into the jack and a small amount of movement jostling it in or out. That seems more likely." But that you could also say that could be, that could go in the favor of, like, well, it wasn't necessarily that someone did it for a particular purpose, but if someone's handling the phone and at that point they had for some reason plugged something in or whatever, that, or maybe it was, I don't know. Like,
I've heard that. That's a good thought. I've heard that. I've heard that perhaps the killer was trying to plug in and listen to the video to see what else was on the video. I've heard lots of different theories with it, but I think that just my point is not that I'm trying to argue one thing or the other. My point is the reason why I think it becomes so hard to argue from either. I think the stronger position to argue from is the expert testified that this is what happened, and there has not been an expert testify to refute that. That's hard to argue with.
The fact is, what makes the Google search so extraordinary is this is not something that was sprung on the prosecution.
Yeah, they had it.
The headphone activity is in Trooper Cecil's 2019 report. He knew about it before anybody else and didn't look into it.
Right. And you said, McClellan said, the prosecutor also knew about it and didn't get an expert to look at it from their side.
Well, Cecil was their expert.
Oh, yeah.
And so nobody over... So they knew about this at least as early as 2019. The trials at the end of 2024, we're talking 5 years. In 5 years, nobody bothered to say, oh, is there a reason this might have happened?
Yeah. And that to me is more telling of anything as far as, you know, all I think most people on both sides complained in the fact that this just wasn't investigated well or properly. So 2019 is before Rick Allen's on their radar. They're not, you know, it's not like they're trying to build a case against him. They're still trying to figure out what happened. And they see this anomaly of headphones being plugged in. And like you said, Michael, like, they never thought we should figure out why that happened or how could that have happened?
Well, didn't they even not? I mean, what I thought I remembered from the trial was that they just didn't even know that that's what that meant. Like, they just didn't even, like, compute that that's, that, you know what I mean? Like, they had the same information she did. And they just were like, oh, we didn't necessarily know that that's what that meant or something. Like, he just didn't know how to read that.
But their expert didn't know what that was.
Yeah, but like Shelley and from our Facebook agrees with you, Michael. Just the whole, she says the whole cell phone data is mind-boggling to me. And it just has lots of questions about chain of custody and trying to figure out if the extraction of the data was accurate and good enough that it even should be relied upon. And, you know, it sounds like there's a lot of people who have a lot of questions around that.
So what was done in 2017 by Trooper Bunner, who was at the time Cecil's boss, it was done on the 15th, and it was a logical extraction, which is a less complete thing than a physical extraction. The physical extraction was done later. The first one was in 2019. I don't know why they waited that long, but my view and the view of some other people who've looked at the phone data is the only truly reliable data is from the 2017 logical extraction. That is the most accurate thing of what was on the phone and not infected by stuff, by exposure to networks, by exposure to the iPad. And fact of the matter is there is stuff in the 2017 logical extraction, for instance, image files, at least one, that's not in the physical extraction. The physical extraction in 2019 should have been more complete. Everything that's in the logical extraction should be in the physical extraction, and the physical extraction should have more. Why are there images missing from the physical extraction that are in the logical extraction?
Oof. Yeah, it's really hard when you feel like, look at how advanced our technology's become. And then at the end of the day, when it's a critical piece of evidence, there's still question about like human interpretation of it and missing pieces between two different extractions and stuff. It's, you know, again, there's a lot to pick apart. And that's why, for many reasons, not the least of which is how this all began and the wonderful girls whose lives were taken, that we just are on both sides, but certainly people who are very concerned about the conviction itself from in terms of its integrity or in terms of missing pieces and stuff like that. Like, of course, everyone's still talking about this because it's just stunning that there are this many things that people interpret differently. But in also other cases, like it's not even interpretation situation. It's just like this evidence was missing, or somebody who thinks he's guilty is like, how can you even, you know, I don't know. It's really hard.
Well, this whole discussion really getting to be framed up as the reason we're having this discussion still is because of all these things, right? So like,
yeah,
you know, it was poorly investigated. It was done sloppily from beginning to end in so many different elements. And that makes a case like this ripe for everybody at the end of it, for nobody to be comfortable with how things worked out.
It just makes me sad because I believe that the investigators were really trying. Like, I mean, I'm not saying that makes them good or that they did a great job. They had to admit to a lot of mistakes for sure. But it just makes me sad because I guess I still hold on to the faith that these people really did care about what happened to these girls, and they cared about the family, and they cared about the town, and whether the FBI came in, and I don't know, that sounds like they were keeping totally separate records, and there's always that jurisdictional bullshit that I keep thinking isn't going to be a thing, but it seems like it's just law enforcement just has a really hard time. Like, the state police are doing this. No, the sheriff's department is doing this. No, now the FBI is involved. And
I can tell you from 15 years working in public safety, it's not just law enforcement. These jurisdictional issues are, and that's what I was going to say. Like, I think they genuinely were doing their best. I think they were not properly equipped to handle it. I think the jurisdictional issues and nobody wanted anybody else playing in their sandbox caused them to push away help that they could have used. They started out on the right track. Like you mentioned earlier, Michael, you mentioned Unified Command. That is from, so I used to teach the National Incident Management System, and that's done properly. NIMS was created in the wake of 9/11. One of the biggest issues in 9/11 was you had all these different agencies from all different elements of government. They were all emerging on the scene. No one knew how to communicate properly. They didn't use the same terminology. They didn't talk in the same way. They weren't using the same incident management systems. And it turned into a big, for lack of a better term, clusterfuck. And so in the wake of that, was created the National Incident Management System that all, not just law enforcement, EMS, fire, public health, everybody in any aspect of, that would be involved in any emergency was all trained. And I used to travel around the country and teach it. So we're all trained to use the same terminology, to organize scenes in the same way, to have the flow of information go in the same way, so that when situations like this emerge, that it can flow smoothly. And the first step in that is, once you realize you're having a multi-agency response to something, is to create a unified. So there's at any incident, whether it's a simple car accident, a fire, a burglary, or whatever, there is an incident commander who then divides up the scene and maintains their span of control. And then when you start to get multiple agencies involved, then you create what's called unified command. And unified command is where you have one head from each of those agencies working together, where all the information flows into this group. So they started out right. And then it just seems like they started out right in the fact that at least the way that they organized it from a public safety perspective, from my perspective, I'll let you rebut me in a minute. From a public safety perspective, creating a unified command is the proper thing to do here. And the way that is supposed to work is that you would have, if you had the FBI involved, you'd have a head from FBI, head from state police, head from local, head from county. If you had, there wouldn't really be EMS involved or anybody like that, but they would all have people that were ideally sitting in a room together. And then as information flows, it should all flow up to them, so everybody's on the same page, which is what unified command is supposed to be. So what I mean by they started out properly is they at least established a unified command earlier. Now, Michael, you can tell me why I'm wrong.
So I don't know whether the FBI was in this unified command. I don't know exactly who was in there, but I know that from the beginning, they shut out anybody who was going to bring up Ron Logan. And they did the same thing later with Greg Ferency and Todd Click and Kevin Murphy about the Odinist stuff. And I don't know why. So they are also the ones responsible for all the, one member of it was responsible for the missing interviews in the first few days. Yes, they did the right thing setting up something called Unified Command. Whatever it was a shambles.
Well, and from my perspective, where I was going with that is they started out right. Like we needed a unified command. We need to put it together. We need a flow of information. But then what happens is personalities come into it as soon as it starts actually functioning. And that's a common pitfall is, even though on paper we're all working together, you've got this agency that's like, well, we're really supposed to be in charge and we think it's this, and this other agency's coming in telling us something else, and they're mucking things up. So we're gonna remove them from the case, and we don't want the FBI in here, and we don't want this group in here because they're disagreeing with us and they're getting in our way. And then all those same jurisdictional battles come in. And so what it looks like to me is they started out with the proper plan, implemented the proper system, and then it deteriorated due to human personalities over time, to where it fell apart.
No, it was terrible. It didn't deteriorate over time. It was terrible from the beginning. As I said, there are two witnesses who completely blow their timeline. Both witnesses talk to law enforcement. I'm not accusing them of leaving the map. They clearly lost track of these people.
Mm. Yeah.
It blows. And this was long before. These two witnesses talked to them within days of the murders. Days.
Yeah, I'm so interested in that. That was definitely another thing I really perked up at in your conversation, the two of you. I was like, oh my God, who are these people? I'm so curious. And yeah, I agree. I can't keep going about that, the tape getting erased. But and then it sounded like I didn't even get a sense that they re-interviewed everyone that they had talked to, that it was just like, well, what's done is done. I mean, maybe I'm misinterpreting that, but it seemed like they didn't even go back and talk to those same people again. They just like maybe hit a few. I don't know.
Well, no, Jerry Holman said, you know, we don't have a list. And then somewhere. So, you know, we didn't re-interview everybody else because we didn't have a list. And then someplace else he says, oh, yeah, we re-interviewed everybody. So I don't know what to believe. I did see on your Facebook page that somebody had asked what I might think about the
I was going to circle back around to that before we finished, because I know we kind of started talking about it a little. And you mentioned that, you know, the characterization of certain things has obviously come from different points of view.
Well, let's go to at least facts, and it ties in with Bridge Guy, and Rick Allen is Bridge Guy. And that is so we have whoever killed the girls, we, at least according to the state's theory, had a gun and a knife. The knife might have been a box cutter, although Core said for 7 years it was two blades, one straight edged, one serrated. But let's say it was a box cutter. At least one of the sticks at the crime scene was sawn off. So Rick Allen, with no history, would have had to go out there with an entire tool chest, a gun, a box cutter, and a saw. And then, and just to cover the girls, and he's in a big hurry, would have sawn off a branch to just toss on them because there weren't enough branches out there. You know, if you think those branches were just dumped there. By the way, the branches, if you've seen any of the leaked crime scene photos, there are some big branches. One especially big. I mean, you have to drag that thing.
And do they maintain that they were just broken off? I mean, does the state maintain that they were broken off even if there's evidence of sawing or?
No, they actually, one of the pictures out there is the picture of the sawn off branch. I mean, I don't think it ever came up at trial. Andrea's a trial expert. I'm not. All I'm saying is that, you know, somebody who just, you know, commits a double murder for the first time in their lives is out there sawing branches away.
That's crazy.
Well, my whole thing with the argument of, and we need to push through and wrap this up because we're over an hour, and I know Janet's in her time zone hasn't even had dinner yet. But
it's worse than that. I apparently was supposed to be recording someone else's podcast at the exact same time.
Oh, whoops.
and I thought that it was a different time zone. So. Oh. Good.
Yeah, so we'll wrap this up real quick. And regarding the branches, my whole thing was just too, like, the argument of they were just put there to conceal the body was, at least from the pictures I saw, they didn't conceal the bodies at all.
Right.
No.
Like, that was,
yeah.
Like...
And that's an ongoing, yeah, that's definitely an ongoing argument.
And I really would, you know, the Franks memo that first laid all this out, I really would commend that. If people should go read it. It's very long. It's 130-some-odd pages. The amount of time it would have taken for one person alone to do all this on the state's timeline is just impossible.
Yeah.
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 And I'm sure, I know we have probably a couple more listeners that we haven't gotten to in, this is what I'm going to say.
We're actually okay. Cause that was Ellen. Ellen wanted to know about that. And I think we've touched on all. The only other thing we had was just Sarah kind of wondering aloud, like, if they didn't release the whole video because they wanted the perpetrator to think they had more evidence than they did. It was just kind of a speculation of why we weren't able to see all of that stuff beforehand.
Yeah. Good. So we can go ahead and wrap this up for now. We've got a couple of the next couple weeks of episodes are planned out. And I always, you know, I'm growing more and more fond of hanging out with Michael the more we hang out with him. So I'm sure there'll be another time throughout this season. I, by the way, as I mentioned, I have to create a logo for this season that in order to give to Katie to get the website updated. And I've decided the title for season 18 is Justice Warriors. That's my goal, is to highlight people who I feel are Justice Warriors. Michael, you were certainly on that list. And the episode that you guys are going to hear on this Sunday, the guest for this Sunday's episode is also on that list. We're going to be hearing from Stephanie Tinsley from the Everything They Missed podcast. Fantastic interview.
Such an impressive podcast.
Yeah,
I listened to all of it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I didn't know her before this or the podcast. I binged it, talked to her. It's amazing. That's coming up on Sunday. And then next week, I've recorded the interview. I've got to do a little more, add some intro and outro stuff to it. But the following week, we're going to jump back to season 17 for one final episode for now, because on Friday, I finally got to meet Chris Bynum and record an interview with Chris Bynum. So that'll be coming out awesome. The following week. So that's what you guys got in store for you for the next couple of weeks. Michael, thanks so much for joining us both last week and again for the follow-up. It's been fantastic having you. What a great conversation.
Yeah, thank you, Michael, for your time and passion about this case.
Thank you all.
You too, JV, on the day that day after Zach didn't wish you happy birthday.
Somehow I was able to make it through.
Yeah, I know you had a busy day, so I appreciate you getting here. And with that being said, we're going to go ahead and wrap this things up. Thanks, everybody. We love you guys. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, everybody. Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @TruthJusticePod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney. And Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.